Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of December 15th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest and prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
That's good. And we're also joined by our other frequent guest and prolific commentator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, good. Good to have you both here. So this has been a consequential week at a national level on issues that you might not think directly connect to climate, but in fact do. There are, of course, this is now, December 15th, Friday of December, the week of December 15th. Earlier this week, there was an interesting political event down in Alabama, but also something else happened even yesterday that had to do with your internet computer, your internet connection, right? So tell me, DR, let me put you on the spot. What happened today at the FCC, and why should we care?
Well, at the FCC, some 30 years after the FCC snuffed out the fairness doctrine and basically allowed for the proliferation of denialism on our radio, by a 3-2 partisan vote, the FCC decided to snuff out net neutrality, which is the principle that says that internet service providers can't play games or play favorites or gouge people for going on certain websites over other websites, which is alarming from a climate perspective because, in theory, websites that will allow for online organizing to protest things associated with climate change could, if you know, could be slowed down in theory if certain internet service providers who have certain political inclinations don't like such websites. So it's a very, very frightening and horrific decision.
I mean, it's a threat to basically free speech, right? I mean,
exactly.
Ultimately, right? I mean, everyone says these words about data speeding up and slowing down some data, but my understanding, and Mariah, I don't know if I've got this right, but my understanding is that the potential is that your internet service will become essentially like cable TV, where certain websites are offered to you and others are choked off. And, you know, you're going to now pay for Google and Facebook, but you may not be able to find other websites that are either competitors or whatever. But, I mean, it's now you get a package of websites. I mean, that's the ultimate place it's going, right? So either of
right,
you
yeah.
agree with that?
So, it sounds like the Republican chairman, Ajit Pai, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but he eliminated the rules that requires companies like Comcast and AT&T to treat all web traffic equally. Mm-hmm. And so instead, now these internet providers can block or slow some web traffic or negotiate paid deals with websites for so-called sort of like fast lanes to consumers. So as DR was saying, now, you know, there can be like, sure, the, you know, 350.org works, but it's really, really, really slow and cumbersome. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only way to get it to speed up is if you have enough money to sort of pay for that fast lane sort of access. Kamala Harris, the U.S. Senator from California, sent out an email that said it's a grave threat to the idea that internet should be free and accessible for all, and that it's a danger to our economy and free speech rights. And said that it reduces innovation, entrepreneurship, and creativity. So she says,
other than that, what's wrong with it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things that I think sort of creep up on us, right? Because Comcast is not going to come down tomorrow with a package of what you have to pay to go on Facebook. But that's where we could end up eventually. And I mean, I agree that ultimately somebody who owns Comcast could decide they don't want to let the Climate Minute podcast be fairly shared with the millions of people that listen to our show, right? I mean, that you could shut down people you don't like. That's not a good thing. Well, tell me, I guess the question is, do you think, I mean, how much has the internet contributed to climate activism? I mean, right? That's a question. Oh, I mean, 350, yeah, I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, 350, right, exactly. 350.org. I mean, that's how they've sort of, that's how they built so many of their movements, you know, from the sort of worldwide activism where they have one day where everybody, you know, does this, some kind of a display and they get pictures of it. Or, you know, when I was in Paris for the Paris Agreement, they organized everything. They organized all of these sort of initiatives via the internet. You know, mm-hmm. you'd go to 350.org and you'd sign up, and then they'd send you an email and tell you where to be and what to do and to wear red and draw a red line, you know, all of these things. And it was all via their website and email. So
you would argue, that a free internet, it has been critical to the development of the success of the climate movement in many ways, right?
Yeah. I mean, so actually 350.org even sent an email out about it. They did a rally on July 12th in support of net neutrality. And they said that they, you know, they spent a lot of time thinking about how to use the internet as a tool to mobilize millions of people to fight for climate justice. Mm-hmm. And to be able to do that, they said, requires a free internet, a place where they can tell the truth without fear of censorship or slowdowns. And so, you know, this decision is basically attacking that fear of censorship, right. Attacking that ability to tell the truth without fear of censorship.
I'm sure when the Koch brothers buy Comcast, I mean, they're going to be very sympathetic to climate hawks, right?
Right.
It's a wow. Well, I guess that's interesting. I hadn't quite thought of it in that stark of terms, but you have an example right in front of you of a use of the internet, which is at risk now because it doesn't make powerful people happy, right? And I suppose there's a lot of other I would imagine like the Me Too thing, and Black Lives Matter has been pretty much not so much an internet phenomena, but has spread virally through the internet, I would say. Right? Would you agree? Mm-hmm. I mean, that you're back to where the social media matters.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wonder how that would. I don't know how it would affect things like Facebook. I guess. Right?
Well, I suppose if you pay enough for Facebook. Right, you can still now post whatever, you know, I'm sure the Russians will be able to post whatever they want on Facebook, right? I mean, if you pay for it, you can get in there. But if you have, I mean, what bothers me is if there's some now clever competitor to Facebook, right, that has the next little twist, they're not going to be able to make it, right, because Facebook's going to crush. It was interesting, I listened to now the New Yorker, the podcast of the New York Times called The Daily. I mean, every morning they have and the guy was saying that, like, the first test of this net neutrality thing was a little internet service provider someplace in Missouri or something that was stopping the internet phone company called Vonage. You remember Vonage?
And
the guy sang the little tune that the Vonage commercials had. It was, I won't even try to sing it. But I mean, you know, Vonage is long gone. But this internet company blocked access to the Vonage website because that internet service provider had its own hardwire telephone service and they didn't want the competition from Vonage. And that was like the beginning of the rulings about net neutrality, how you couldn't block off these. But now, Mr. Pai, Ajit Pai and his buddies have basically neutered all that, and they're going to give the internets over to the most powerful and richest people.
Yeah,
Mr. Pai is a pain, is he not?
Mr. Pai is a pain.
I don't. There also was this interesting twist to it. Speaking of Russia, that there was a bunch of, like, you know, I don't know, hundreds and thousands, maybe a million fake comets that were traced back to Russia.
Comments
on their website. And attorneys general that are planning to challenge it in court because of that.
Right. There was something like 500,000 comments that came in from some sort of robot, you know, with these sort of little, you know, computer programs that send in emails, right? They generate emails and make, and there were 500, something like 500,000 of them to the FCC in favor of killing net neutrality, right? Yeah, I agree with that. So, DR, you were mentioning before that this is being blocked by the, or not blocked, by, opposed by some state attorneys general?
Yes, two states attorney general, Bob Ferguson, who's the attorney general for Washington State, and Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general of New York, have both launched challenges and basically saying that this runs afoul of equal protection to try to get rid of net neutrality, and they're confident that they can win. We shall certainly see.
But I mean, it's just interesting that the how shall we say, the blue state attorneys general are, it's attorney generals, right? Not attorneys general. The attorney generals.
Attorneys general.
Attorneys general? Okay. Yep. The attorneys general and the blue states are now playing kind of the same role that the red state guys played under Obama, right? They are the bulwark that keeps pushing back in a legal sense to try and stop. And of course, that we should note that because I think Schneiderman in particular has been a climate guy, right? Our own attorney general, now I'm embarrassed, Attorney General Healey has been pushing back. So, I mean, this is the sort of locus of opposition, the locus of resistance on a political front. Interesting, interesting. Mm. Well, okay, there's net neutrality. If the Climate Minute disappears from your webpage, dear listener, please come straight. Maybe we'll be speaking very slowly if we get our internet speeds throttled, but... Okay, so there's that. There's net neutrality, not a good thing. Boo on them. But then, Mariah, tell me, what happened in the sovereign state of Alabama this past Tuesday that climate hawks ought to probably do know, I think, but probably ought to be celebrating?
It was a blooming miracle, wasn't it? Yes, Doug Jones won the Senate seat in Alabama, upset Roy Moore. To the sexual allegations against Roy Moore. And of course, this is good news for the Democrats as it puts the balance in the Senate one step closer to 50-50. I think it's 51-49, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think something of note is that Mitch McConnell, so of course, there's this big tax bill that's being voted on right now. And having Jones in there to help, you know, vote against the tax bill, which he said he would do, will certainly stop this tax bill, which as a climate hawk, I want it to be stopped, right? Because there's all of these ways that they're crippling renewable energy that got, you know, squeaked into this tax bill. And so the problem is that Mitch McConnell doesn't really seem to be interested in holding off voting until Jones is seated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think generally it takes about 15 to 21 days after winning an election, just so they can account for absentee ballots and, you know, verifying the count before they will seat a Senate, someone who's won the election.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if you guys remember, you probably do, back when Republican Scott Brown was elected to fill the Liberal Lions Head Kennedy's seat when he passed away. The Obamacare vote, the healthcare vote was going on. And so there was some sort of, you know, dancing around with that. But ultimately, the then majority leader, Democrat Harry Reid, said that we're going to wait until the new senator arrives before we do anything more on healthcare. So we actually did wait for Brown to come before he did anything. So there's sort of this precedent about, you know, that it would be, it's, you know, they should wait. They should
it's
wait
good process.
There.
It's good
yeah,
process.
Exactly.
It's a good way to run things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So do you think he's gone?
No, it doesn't sound like he has any interest in that. I mean, who knows? But he certainly does not seem like he wants to hold. I think they want to get it done before Christmas was sort of what I've been hearing. Yeah. And I think they're probably especially anxious to push it through now.
And I don't think the Democrats have much leverage, right? There's not really many ways they can slow it down. I mean, it seems to me that if the Democrats... If Chuck Schumer really wanted to gum up the works, there would be some Machiavellian way that I'm sure Mitch McConnell was already aware of that that they could goober things up in the Senate, right? But, I mean, the Democrats, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you want to believe in the process. And if one side's abusing the process of sort of due deliberation, I don't know. I mean, I agree with you. I think that the only way you can, I mean, to, of course, here in Massachusetts, we have... two stalwart climate hawk, two blue senators. But if you live in a state that's got a Republican senator, this is an opportunity to call up and demand that Republican senator tell Mitch McConnell that he wants Doug Jones to be seated, right? Just as good procedure, as good norms, as good policy for how we should do things.
So, you know, of note, Jay Sekulow, who's currently one of Trump's private attorneys, said, you know, back in regards to Brown's election, he said, you know, there's no reason to wait to seat Senator-elect Brown, and with each passing day, he's prevented from participating in a legislative process. And he said it's an unacceptable delay tactic on the part of the Senate leadership, and it's a tactic that disenfranchises the voters of Massachusetts who sent a strong message in the election. So this is what he said of the Brown thing, and it, of course, I haven't heard him speaking up in the same manner for Doug Jones and not disenfranchising the voters of Alabama.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, and as you mentioned, Mariah, I think that the Doug Jones, it doesn't appear that Doug Jones has made strong statements about any kind of environmental or climate issues, but his presence.
I think he has.
Really?
I think he has said, yes, I'm pretty sure that I read he has come out vocally in support. I think it was even a little bit of a part of his platform.
All right.
Have you heard that, DR?
Yes, that he defended the Paris Climate Agreement, said that we should stay in. He did express strong support for clean energy, and that's the thing that sort of makes this outcome all the more shocking, because, you know, this is only 7 years removed from another Southern legislator, Bob Inglis, being forced out of his seat in a primary because he dared to say similar things, and now 7 years later, you know, somebody who can stand on the side of clean energy and science can win in the reddest of red states.
Well, so good on Doug Jones then. And I think it's important, I mean, from a climate perspective, it's important that Doug Jones be seated in time to vote on this disaster of a tax bill, or at least to oppose it, right, and be one more vote against it because of the implications for the renewable energy industry, right, Mariah, as you mentioned. I mean, that this bill, this tax bill is not good for wind turbines, solar panels, any kind of financing of renewable energy stuff, and these guys, it should be pushed to a halt. Okay, so there's that aspect of it. One other aspect of the whole Alabama election that I found interesting was that it is further proof that when people engage in the process of electing people, they win, right? The activists in Alabama, I mean, it was pretty bleak, right, when it all started out for Doug Jones, because he was going to lose by 35 points to whoever the Republicans put up, and here ultimately he wins. And it's because of the people on the ground organizing and getting out the vote and being active, and it's kind of a message and example to the rest of us that there's more elections coming and we need to be involved, right? Would you guys agree with that?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of amazing voters that got out in Alabama and made the difference.
Right. And so we all get to do that. There are elections coming in all of our states. I'm not sure if there's a general election here in Massachusetts before 2018, but man, we got to start getting ready for it, right? So tell me, DR, when we talk about these high-level ideas of national policy, of course, our so-called president, the abuser in chief there, he has made no secret of his distaste for climate or climate scientists, but there is a very, very handsome guy over in France who seems to be welcoming of climate scientists. Tell me, what did Mr. Macron do over in Paris lately?
Yes, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has offered grants to 13 United States-based climate scientists to continue their research in France and to have the full support of the French government in doing so, as opposed to what the United States is doing. I have to quote Brad Friedman on his Green News report, where he said, you know, we have to rely upon France for the backing of U.S.-based, you know, climate research. Just paraphrasing what he said, he said that this is Macron said that this is an effort to, as he put it, make our planet great again. And he offered a competition for $70 million of research grants awarded for as long as 5 years. And it does raise the question where you have other, developed countries, prosperous countries that are signatories to the Paris Climate Agreement, why don't they step up and do the same thing and make sure that this sort of funding is on a consistent basis? Because as we've both previously noted, there's this, you know, frustration in the United States that depending on which way the political winds shift, there's, you know, funding for climate research in one administration, funding is slashed in another administration, it's restored again. It's the what I've called the climate hokey pokey.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to have other developed countries that are saying, no, we stand four square behind the funding and support of scientific research. So this should be considered a challenge to other the developed countries that can afford to do so, to step their game up and to stand behind science and make make their own offers to researchers to basically say, hey, we will back you if you come over here and continue to do your research, since it's the United States, but depending on political considerations, seems to scorn you every so often.
Well, but Mariah, I thought, did you hear something that said that in fact, not only are the countries seeking climate scientists, but climate scientists are seeking other countries, right? I mean, are people looking around? What'd you hear?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, this was in reference to Macron. It was one of the winners of the awards that he offered. A professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University named Lewis A. Derry said that, you know, he's excited to be working with, you know, French colleagues and not be so dependent on the crazy stuff that's going on with Congress. And also that he's embarrassed to try to explain what's going on at home right now. And, you know, then another winner said that, you know, it was a psychological boost to have someone, to have a head of state actually valuing what, you know, what I do. Right, and you right. think about if you're trying to do climate science here in the United States and you can't, you know, I mean, there's so many climate scientists that, you know, can't mention the word climate science when they're applying for a grant, right? Because they won't get the grant and they have to sort of dance around what they really want to study. And, you know, you feel like you're kind of like doing something wrong by studying this really important topic. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I agree with DR. There should be more countries. I mean, well, obviously, really, the United States just needs
right.
to get
we, that we need
straight,
to get our but, act together. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, you know, at the very
those,
least,
those darn countries. Canadians aren't spending enough money on our scientists, right? We need, but I agree. I mean, it was interesting. I heard a speaker the other night saying how, in fact, since the election of President, the guy we got, how the rest of the world, since the organization of the Paris Accords, they're all moving ahead. Right. The United States is no longer controlling the conversation, and all these other countries are united and pushing ahead in building the Paris structure. And so we should take heart from that we may be temporarily a backwater, but the world is moving, and that's a good thing. So,
yeah,
well, all right. Well, look,
train.
We have consumed already 22 minutes and 35 seconds. Probably we need to, we need to end our conversation here. But let me say that we will, you can, of course, we'll put up links to most of what we talked about on our blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. We, as you can say, could read the links and listen to the podcast file. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or Overcast, or Podbean, or SoundCloud. And, of course, you can find us on iTunes. So we will close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And Mariah, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care and bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.